Russia now, I do have a sense that I worry that my friends who are still in Russia, my very voluble Russian friends, whom I have always admired as speakers and as people who can just off the cuff give like a 45-minute lecture, because that's something that the Russian school system can train you to do, I worry that they are maybe being silenced. And I don't want to sort of, in too jocular a way, dismiss the idea of political silencing. I think there is silencing, and there is silencing now of people in Russia who are worried about being arrested, because there's lots of arrests happening right now for speaking or for things that are actions that are taken to be certain kinds of speech. So that's true. That happens. And at the same time, I'm skeptical at the idea that just voicing means liberation. I do think I sat in on a class at Stanford by Jonathan Rosa. He's a linguistic anthropologist teaching in our school of education. And I know he talks a lot about the certain kind of hypocrisy associated with the idea that speaking for a subordinate group that one belongs to is a kind of liberation. And he draws attention to all the ways in which actually people can be forced to speak for their subordinate or minoritized group. And that's not liberation. That's maybe performing a role that's useful for someone at some time, but it's not necessarily your choice. So I'm coming into this question with an awareness of all the different meanings of silence. In my mid-19th century materials, I saw ways that silence is both embraced, as I mentioned, by the Slavophiles. I have a chapter on Hochstausen, so another of those mid-19th century visitors to the empire. This one is a German visitor to the empire, a German-speaking visitor to the empire. He loves the idea of this tranquility, Russian tranquility. It's beautiful. And he wishes that German speakers would still have it, but they've lost it. But in Russia, they still have this tranquility. So this kind of fantasy of a healthy, essential, community-affirming silence that's very available to the people I look at. And at the same time, they explore other kinds of silence. Grigorovich, in his very famous story, Derevnya, The Village, about a kind of abused peasant woman, he writes really, I think, movingly about her refusal to speak as the one way that she can claim a kind of agency. Some people are skeptical of that story and they criticize it. They say he produces this peasant woman and she doesn't even speak. And, you know, that's bad. But I feel like there are times and places where people can gain power by not speaking and by refusing to speak. So yeah, silence is like sound. It's not like there's just one kind of sound. We know that. So there's not one kind of silence.
Yeah. I did this kind of cheap thing where I did a word search of your book for soundscape. And one of the things that jumped up at me, this is the beauty of having electronic books rather than actual. One of the things that jumped out to me is that when the word soundscape came up, the word distinctive Russian soundscape was used a few times. First off, there clearly seems to be some search for it, at least from your subjects. But were you able to identify a distinctive Russian soundscape? And what is that?
What is that? Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, the word soundscape, I think, is associated in sound studies. It's associated with sort of the natural world a little bit more than with the urban world. People are intrigued by the notion of the soundscape of New Guinea. And in that context, I think, on the one hand, I'm skeptical about the idea that there's something just Russian, that there's a way of hearing sound, there's a way that sound resonates against trees. And yes, I'm skeptical that happens only in Russia. And at the same time, I'm willing to believe that far northern places with cold weather and snow, sound might work differently from how it works in very warm jungles. I think that's probably correct. Probably different sorts of trees, different sorts of levels of moisture in the air, different presence of birds and insects creates a different kind of sound. and that the human voice is heard differently in different sound environments, right? We understand that very well ourselves, right? We know that we sound different when we're out in the woods than if we're on Times Square. Yeah, we're tempted to speak differently and we sound different. And so I do think there's probably such a thing as a soundscape of these northern places, such as those described by the people I write about. But are those soundscapes only to be found in Russia? Might they be found also in Canada? Probably.
Gabriela, as an anthropologist, I'm going to ask an ethnographic question, or maybe ethnographically leaning question. I have a sense that listening to people's voices, especially from marginalized or historically dispossessed groups, has become a political and ethical slogan or maybe call, right? And given your research about efforts to listen to people's voices, what do you think about this agenda, about this program within engaged scholarship?
I mean, I'm really fascinated by it. And I think that program or its kind of pop manifestations is part of what's inspired me. You know, I see on the one hand, Anski's memoirists were really excited at the idea of him as an especially virtuosic listener. On the other hand, I teach a class for many years. Every year I would teach this class on folklore and literature at Stanford to freshmen and sophomores. And they would have to collect living folklore from some group to which they had access. So sometimes it was like ghost stories from their dorm or stories about their grandfather as relayed by all their different cousins, different kinds of groups that they had access to. And I became so fascinated by my students' desire to provide voice or to attend to the voices of marginalized people and to define maybe sometimes people I didn't think of as that marginalized as marginalized in order to justify their own work. And I also was so fascinated by my students' sort of sense of the high stakes of the task that I was asking them to do. Sometimes when I felt that the stakes were maybe not that high, they felt high. I think something, oh, I had a wonderful paper once about Mormon girls' summer camp songs. And my student who was Mormon felt like in order to gather some of these songs, to record them, she needed to get a group of girls who had gone to those camps together in her dorm room and to sing together these songs. And she did. And she wrote this really great paper. And I felt like, I don't know how, is she going to exploit these, her friends who also went to these Mormon summer camps? I don't think so. But you know, even in that case, where it would seem like the identity of the researcher aligns pretty neatly with the identity of the researched subjects, and that they're all Stanford students who are Mormon, who went to girls' summer camps, who are maybe sophomores, you know, like they're pretty similar. Even in that case, in speaking with my students, whom I mostly find brilliant and just so thoughtful, it was just fascinating for me to realize that, okay, this student is picking up on ways that she is maybe not fully adequately listening to or representing the experiences of these other students who seem so similar to her in their feelings about these songs that they sang at summer camp about like Noah's Ark and whatever. And I think the current interest in this subject is inspirational. And my work, my teaching has made me so aware of the difficulty of representing a group, the difficulty of knowing as a researcher, a transcriber, that you're going to then adequately represent a group, or that you can claim to adequately be representing a group with your research. And then the difficulty of any speaker who maybe presents themselves as a representative of that group. Is that speaker really a representative of that group? What does that even mean? That's a kind of big philosophical, a political philosophy question, but it's also a sort of small technical question about like, what can you say? How can you label your recordings? So I guess the answer to your question is I have been fascinated by the discourse you're describing. I'm inspired by it. And I think that it opens up questions that we don't have answers to, we don't have easy answers to in the present. And that the people that I was writing about, my mid-19th century listeners in the Russian Empire, my Stanford students, are these like incredibly brilliant, thoughtful people who themselves were aware of the limitations of their own claims.
That was Gabriela Safran. Gabriela Safran teaches in the Slavic department at Stanford, where she is the Eva Chernov Low-Key Professor in Jewish Studies. She is a specialist in late imperial Russian and Yiddish literatures, folklore, and lexicography. Her recent books include Wandering Soul, the D-Book's creator S. Anski, the co-edited volume The Whole World in a Book, Dictionaries in the 19th Century, and Recording Russia, Trying to Listen in the 19th Century, published by Cornell University Press.
And I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This episode was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. You know, editing a podcast doesn't have to be a hassle, and it can take a lot of time. That's why we here at Eurasian Knot have partnered with Podcuts Editing to utilize Daniel's great service to streamline our production process and increase our podcast quality. So if you're interested in his services, please head to www.podcutsediting.com, and Daniel will give you your first edit for free. And as you know, the Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh and listeners like you. You can really help us out by becoming a patron to the podcast. Donating a couple of bucks every month goes a long way. And if for whatever reason you can't do that, then we'd greatly appreciate it. You spread the word, share this episode and other episodes on social media with family, to talk about the podcast with your friends and let them know what we're doing here. So, until next time,
bye-bye.
Is this thing on? Can you hear me now?
Zolang de raad van bestuur van Scorpio er niet achterkomt dat we op hun kosten een prachtige home studio hebben ingericht, inclusief metershoge planten en professionele keuken met dampkap, dan kunnen we je wekelijks een nieuwe signeurhuis serveren. Goedenavond en welkom. Beginnen doen we met de Toronto Blessings. De bandnaam is een beetje misleidend, want ze komen uit Barnsley, een stadje in het noorden van Engeland. En zelf noemen ze zich als The Noisiest Thing sinds het einde van de kolenindustrie. Maar dat valt wel mee in het eerste nummer van hun nieuwe plaatje. Dit is Call Your Name van Toronto Blessings.
Take the heart, the mind, the soul.
Suicide in the Kitchen, een knap solo geluidsknutselwerkje van Alicia Breton-Ferrer. Ook actief bij The Sweet Release of Dead en Neighbors Burning Neighbors. Vanuit haar Rotterdams appartementje, vergezeld met haar roommate en huiskatte Iggy, probeerde ze de lockdowntijd nuttig te besteden. Dat was ook een beetje een moeilijke periode waar een draaiende droogkast haar tot rust kon brengen. De aanleiding voor deze titel No Suicide in the Kitchen. Nog een paar weekjes geduld en dan kunnen we de rest van haar platen Headache Sorbet ontdekken. Het Mexicaanse Normal Festival maakt elke maand een redelijk vage show voor YouTube, Normal Camarade TV. Ze vragen bands om het nodige materiaal voor die show aan te leveren en laat vaag, tripperig en lichtjes gestoord nu de ideale begrippen zijn om onze favoriete krautrockers Beak te omschrijven. Tijdens de lockdown maakten ze dit Oh No van Beak. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
We Were Never Being Boring zijn niet alleen de gevleugelde woorden van synthpop duo Pet Shop Boys, maar is ook de naam van een Italiaans DIY-collectief. De nieuwste aanwinst van het collectief is de band Alpaca. En onlangs verscheen Make It Better, daaruit draaiden we Chameleon. Wat er van de bands Negative Scanner en The Human Beat uit Chicago gekomen is, dat weten we niet, maar we weten wel dat enkele leden van voorgenoemde bands een nieuwe gestart zijn. Spread Joy, hun debuut is vers van de pers vandaag uit op Feel It Records. 10 nummers in 14 nummers gebouwd, zoals dit snedige maar prettige baba van Spread Joy.
Bye.
Zo, nu hebben we ze voor de volledigheid allemaal gedraaid. Dit was het vierde nummer dat we uit de EP Manifesto van Sprints draaiden. Dit was het slotnummer Ashley. Of we dit een leuk plaatje of een EP'tje vinden, ik dacht het wel. Een paar jaar geleden bereikte Foundlings lokale bekendheid in de buurt van Brighton. Een opgestapt bandlid, recent ouderschap en een claim van een Amerikaanse gelijknamige band. Later zijn ze herboren als Hedaby. Eind deze maand verschijnt hun debuut Another Life. Dat namen ze in 5 dagen op. Dit is Wait in the Dark van Hedaby.
Lady, cool Ronnie. safely into a short boat.
Een smart lady van Try Cleaning. Vandaag verschijnt het langverwachte debuut New Long Lake van dit Londense viertal. De videoclip van dit nummer namen het slimme indie meisje Florence Shaw en haar vriendjes op in een leegstaande tapijtenwinkel. En deze haalden we vers van de vroegmarkt, de nieuwe van het Luikse powerkwartet Edith Anita. Vandaag geoogst en in de winkel. Er staan verbazend veel rustige nummers op deze keer, maar natuurlijk ook een paar vintage Edith Anita nummers, zoals dit More.
You sell these things that I adore. gotta find a way out of here. Can't find a way out of here. Someone told me there was a way.
Dit waren de 90s gitaren van Low Moder, een nieuwe band uit Lincoln. Three Times Hall of Famer is te vinden op een titeloze debuut van begin dit jaar. En dan duiken we in een 8 minuten durende trip van het Britse Concrete Chips. Vibration White Finger is een geweldig nummer uit de nieuwe plaat In Observance. Een nummer dat uitblinkt door zijn eenvoud, bijna helemaal opgebouwd uit één basriff met enkele klagende dissonante gitaren die in het midden over elkaar heen buitelen. Laat je meevaren, dit is Concrete Chips met Vibration White Finger.